You are listening to The Evidence Locker. Our cases have been researched using open source and archive materials. It deals with true crimes and real people. Each episode is produced with the utmost respect to the victims, their families, and loved ones. Warning: this episode has details of brutal attacks and sexual assaults. Listener discretion is advised. It was May 3rd, 1989. Peggy Olive was an outpatient at the Dr. George's L. Dumont Hospital in New Brunswick, Canada. She was in her car, ready to go home, when a fierce, bearded man forced his way into her vehicle and pushed her into the passenger seat. Keeping Peggy captive, the man held a sharp object to her neck. Peggy was petrified. The man had a sense of pure evil about him. She begged that he would let her go. But as he was speeding away from the hospital, there was no stopping him. Peggy realized this man was very dangerous. One minute he would be threatening and aggressive, then he would suddenly become nice and polite, almost charming. His unpredictability was unnerving. Peggy felt like she was trapped inside her car with a ticking time bomb. To her surprise, the man stopped the car and told her to get out. She did not waste any time and jumped out as quickly as she could. Before he drove off, he said to her that he promised he wouldn't damage her car. Peggy Olive saw the man drive off and was suddenly engulfed by a new wave of fear. If he used her vehicle registration details, he would be able to see her home address in Moncton on the banks of the Miramichi River. Would he return to finish the nightmare he had started? The Miramichi is the term that locals affectionately use when they talk about the area along the mighty Miramichi River in New Brunswick. It is a scenic area, popular with fishermen and people who love the outdoors. In the Miramichi, there is a strong sense of community. Locals are friendly and help each other out when needed. People wave hello to passersby, and there is always time for a chat. In 1989, there was an element of innocence associated with the Miramichi. Kids cycled along the river, boarded a ferry to cross the water. On the Chatham side, they would go to Flam's grocery store to buy sweets. People would leave their keys in their cars in the driveway, and it was a safe and peaceful place to live. This peace was shattered on June 21st, 1986. 66-year-old John Glendenning and his wife, 64-year-old Mary, who owned and operated the local convenience store in Black Ridge, closed their store for the night. They lived in a house adjacent to the shop. That night, as they were ready to lock up for the night, the shop suddenly went dark. Before they could make their way to the power box, three masked men barged in. The robbers demanded the couple give them all their money. John told them where the safe was, but that wasn't enough. The three men launched a violent attack on the couple, beating and slapping them, and raping a defenseless Mary. Once the trio were done, they left the couple for dead. Mary was beaten unconscious, barely alive, but miraculously regained consciousness. She had made her way to John, who was not conscious. Determined to survive, Mary crawled to their home upstairs, above the shop, and called for help. Within minutes, emergency services arrived. They managed to save Mary, but sadly, John was already dead. Eyewitnesses gave valuable information to police after seeing three men with a safe and more money that they could possibly have earned honestly. The men were known to police as they were local petty criminals, but they had never murdered before. The robbers were 38-year-old Alan Legere and two young men in their late teens, Todd Matchett and Scott Curtis. All three men were arrested and found guilty at their trial 6 months later. Legere was seen as the leader of the wicked trio as he was older and more experienced. Police knew that he was one of the most feared criminals in the area. Even other criminals were afraid of him. He had a violent streak, and nobody messed with him. After receiving a life sentence for the murder of John Glendenning, Legere appealed his conviction, but the appeal was unsuccessful. It was deemed that the best place for someone like Alan Legere was behind bars. At the Atlantic Institution Maximum Security Penitentiary in Renews, Legere was kept in a segregation unit. He was a model prisoner who never gave the guards any trouble. He even built up a rapport with some of them. Warden Don Wheaton was wary of Legere and felt that he had a Jekyll and Hyde personality. If he liked you, he was nice. If he didn't, he was dangerous. But Legere learnt to keep his dark side under control in prison, as good behavior meant better treatment by the guards. Legere was 38 years old and looking at a lifetime in prison. He had all the time in the world to reflect on his past and what went wrong along the way. Alan Legere was born on Friday the 13th, February 1948, in Chatham Head on the banks of the Miramichi River. It was a poor neighborhood, and locals knew it to be a rough place. Legere's mother, Louise, was a single mother of three when she fell pregnant with him. She rented out rooms in the family home for extra money. That is how she met Legere's father. He was one of her lodgers. But the father didn't stay around, and before long, Louise was a single mother of four. The Legere kids grew up in a home with a lot of people moving in and moving out. Young Alan Legere shared a bedroom with his sisters and watched them dress and undress. He found it hard to resist his sexual urges and often masturbated as he watched them. At school, the feelings about Legere were dubious. Some felt that he was bright with a promising future, despite his poor upbringing. Other teachers and peers did not like him and thought that he was up to no good. When he was 15, his brother was run over as he was walking over a local bridge. He died. His mother's grief was intense, and she turned on her remaining troubled son, Alan, often telling him that it should have been him who had died. Alan's mother, Louise, also brought many sexual partners home. She was not very discreet, and an adolescent Alan struggled to cope with the situation. At the age of 16, he had had enough and dropped out of school and left home. The community was not supportive of Alan Legere as a teenager with a troubled upbringing. In fact, he was very much disliked. As time went on, he became somewhat of a drifter, committing minor crimes around the Miramichi area. Legere was a scrawny young man and realized that, in order to survive in the tough neighborhood of Chatham Head, he needed to buff himself up. He went to the gym obsessively every day. He wanted to show that he was a strong and dangerous man, and his efforts paid off. He soon became muscular, and the size of his body started to match the size of his attitude. And over time, he transformed himself into a big, scary man. His brushes with the law were deemed to be petty crimes. He broke into homes and stole items of minimal value. But the way he committed the break-ins was unsettling. People would wake up and saw him standing at the end of the bed watching over them. If they didn't wake up, he would leave something behind on the bed to let them know that he was there. He even cut the underwear off from a sleeping female minister. Stories of his terrifying crimes made the front pages of the local newspapers. Legere loved the notoriety and the fact that people were afraid of him. After a couple of short stints in prison for theft, he made his way to Ottawa, where he worked as a car salesman. He married and had two kids. When Legere's wife found out about his infidelity with various other women, the marriage broke up. Legere hated the Catholic Church. He was quite outspoken about his feelings and made accusations of corruption and greed within the church. When his rants weren't provoking the desired responses from whoever was listening, he would refer to Satanism to get a shock. He just loved to instill fear into people. He knew that he was poor, he realized other people had more, and he hated that. Legere's feelings of inferiority made him want to show power and control. By being fierce, he had something about him. From a forensic psychology point of view, he targeted elderly victims like John and Mary Glendenning, or sleeping victims because they were vulnerable, completely at his mercy. They were weak targets which shadowed his own internal weakness. Prison was the best place for someone with Leger's lust for violence. But he wasn't planning on sticking around. Leger had a plan. He had started gathering his own urine, which he poured into his ear. This caused an ear infection. He knew that an infection would mean that he had to go see a specialist, which would grant him a pass to leave the prison and go to the hospital in Moncton. On May 3, 1989, 3 years into his incarceration, two guards escorted Alan Leger from the Atlantic Institution to the Georges L. Dumont Regional Hospital. Leger was prepared. He had made a lockpick, which he hid in a cigarette. As they were driving to the hospital, he managed to unlock his handcuffs and shackles. He did it in such a way that they appeared to still be locked. Once inside the hospital, as one guard was signing him in at reception, he convinced the other guard to let him use the toilet. Remember, up to this point, Leger had been a model prisoner. He played by the rules and always obeyed prison officials' orders. The guard with Leger allowed him to go to the toilet by himself while he waited outside the door. Once Leger was alone, he took off his handcuffs and shackles, then as planned, retracted a TV antenna, which he had hidden in a body cavity. He called out to the guard and asked for toilet paper. Once the guard opened the door, he immediately saw Leger's handcuffs and shackles in the basin. Leger used the antenna as a weapon to keep the guard at bay and made his escape. Both guards tried to stop him, but he managed to make it out of the hospital and into the parking lot where he came across outpatient Peggy Olive in her car, about to leave the hospital. After letting Peggy go a couple of miles down the road, Leger dumped her vehicle on the outskirts of Moncton. As he promised, her car was unharmed. Peggy was lucky to have escaped alive. Authorities reacted in force. Helicopters, roadblocks, and sniffer dogs were used to look for the escaped convict. But they could not find Leger. The general feeling was that he had fled the area and gone to Montreal or Halifax. Alan Leger was well known in the Miramichi, and if he stayed around the area, he would certainly be recognized. It was like Leger had vanished into thin air. There was a high alert around the greater Moncton area, but no sightings of Leger. But after a couple of days, something changed. An auspicious cloud pulled in over the Miramichi. There was an increase in reports of a prowler further north, in the area on the banks of the Miramichi River. Was Leger so brazen that he returned home? Police suspected that it was indeed Leger stalking the area under the cover of night. Bizarre incidents started to happen around the Miramichi. Residents would notice that someone had been inside their homes, but they could not see how the person broke in. Food and other random items were stolen. One night, a Chatham woman whose husband was working a night shift at a local factory was at home with her children. The kids were sleeping upstairs when she saw a man on her front porch trying to break into her house. When the man realized that she had seen him, he ran away, breaking a window as he ran past it. Breaking the window was unnecessary. It was really just an act to invoke further terror. With growing suspicion of the prowler indeed being Leger, police feared that Leger had returned to take revenge on the community as a whole. He hated the people of his hometown. He never felt that he fitted in. 4 days after Leger's escape, a Newcastle man was beaten, tied up, and robbed by a masked intruder. His wallet and car were found a couple of days later, but there was no sign of the perpetrator. 3 weeks later, another Chatham resident fell victim to a burglary. This time, the resident, Joe Irving, was not held up. He noticed that meat to the value of $100 was stolen from his freezer, along with a duffel bag, probably to carry the meat in. Around the corner from Joe's house was Flam's grocery store. The store had been run by Annie Flam for the past 50 years. She lived upstairs, next door to her sister-in-law, Nina Flam. Annie was well-loved in the community, and people would describe her as being everybody's grandmother. Annie was kind and friendly and loved chatting to her customers. Her store was somewhat of a local landmark. It was open from 7 a.m. until 11 p.m., 7 days a week. Her sister-in-law, Nina, was married to Annie's brother, Bernie, and they had 5 grown-up daughters. After Bernie passed away in 1973, Nina lived alone in the second apartment upstairs from Flam's grocery store. When Nina was younger, she worked at the liquor store in Chatham, but in her later years, she would help out more often in Annie's store. Annie was 75 years old, and Nina, a much younger 61. The sisters-in-law had a good relationship, and the living arrangement with their adjoining duplexes worked well for them. On Sunday, May 29th, 1989, Nina was already upstairs when Annie locked the store at 11 p.m. Annie went into the hallway with the 3 connecting doors. One led into the store, one went to Annie's townhouse, and the other to Nina's townhouse. Just before 4 a.m., passerby saw smoke coming from the upstairs of Flam's grocery store. Harry Preston from Newcastle ran to the house and pounded on the door. A passing police car also saw the flames and alerted the fire department. The officers broke down the back door and found Nina Flam at the bottom of the stairs, partly clothed and badly injured. Nina was barely conscious. Officer Dan Pugh wrapped his jacket around her and called for an ambulance. As Nina was rushed to the hospital, firefighters fought the blaze and looked for Annie Flam. With the fire under control, they found Annie's body on her bed. The bed was completely burnt out. All that was left was the springs and the bed frame. The petite 5-foot, or 1.5 meter, Annie was burnt beyond recognition. From Annie and Nina's injuries, it was evident that they weren't only caused by fire. Both were severely beaten, and whoever attacked them lit the fire to conceal evidence. There was a lot of structural damage to the property, with the center of the roof burnt out. Police were desperate for answers. They had to talk to the only person who could help them. Nina Flam was fighting for her life in the hospital. When she regained consciousness, she was able to tell police the dark and sordid details of what happened to her on that Sunday night. She went upstairs around 9:30, made herself some coffee and a snack. Around 10:30, Annie came upstairs to Nina's townhouse, and they chatted for a while before Annie went downstairs to the shop to lock up for the night. Nina went to bed around 11 p.m. and snuggled in with a book to read. Her daughter called just as she got into bed, and they had a short conversation. After she hung up, Nina continued reading and fell asleep. Later that night, as Nina was sleeping with her back to her bedroom door, she heard footsteps coming up the stairs. A masked man entered. He put his hand over her mouth. He told her, "Don't make a noise, and I won't hurt you." The man asked her where her pantyhose were and rummaged through her drawers to find a pair. He tied Nina's feet up and also tied her hands behind her back. He placed a pillow over her face so she couldn't see him. Nina was terrified and complied with everything the intruder asked her to do. Her arm was in a cast from an injury she had sustained a couple of weeks prior, so it was rather uncomfortable lying on top of her broken arm, but this was the least of her concerns. Who was this man? What did he want from her? The masked man went around her townhouse looking for valuables. He kept circling back to Nina, chatting to her. He said his name was Gerald, and that he had had a drink of whiskey, and Nina could smell it on him. He also asked her if she still worked at the liquor store. The man who called himself Gerald then asked Nina about her daughter, who lived in Halifax, but had visited that weekend and left that morning. Gerald said that he had seen her with her high school boyfriend in Chatham on the weekend. It was clear that Nina's captor was a local to the area and that he knew her family. Nina later said, "He knew my family, but not that well. He only knew a little." The intruder then demanded to know where the Flams kept the cash from the grocery store, threatening Nina with a knife. Nina told him that there was no money in the house and the only cash she had was $60 in her purse. This was not what the man wanted to hear, and he beat Nina in her face with his fist. He demanded to know where the money from the store was. Nina answered truthfully. Annie kept the money in the bank. She made regular deposits during the week, and there was not any money on the premises. The man exploded. This was a Sunday. Banks were closed. Where was the money from today? Nina honestly did not know where Annie kept it. The man continued to beat her violently. As a last resort, he said, "If you don't tell me where the money is, I will rape you." Nina said again that there honestly was no money in the house, only the cash that was in her purse. So he raped her. And as he raped her, he yelled at her, blaming everyone who had ever done him wrong. "You rich people, you think you have everything your way?" In a sordid conversation during the act of rape, he asked about her husband, which he called by his name, Bernie. He also called her by her name or referred to her as Mrs. Bernie. After the rape, the man was still adamant to know where Annie kept her money. Nina said that she really did not know. And besides, many of the customers paid by check. There was not a lot of cash in the store. The man was furious. So he raped Nina a second time. When the assault finally ended, the man tucked her into her bed, but cut the ties around her hands. He then put his hands on her neck and choked her. Nina pretended to be dead, and he stepped away from her. Before he left, Nina's attacker lit a fire in her cupboard and set her mattress on fire. He left the room and shut the door behind him, leaving her for dead. The fire spread rapidly, and Nina had to get out of there. She managed to untie her feet and made her way down the stairs. The next thing she remembered was someone pounding on the door, and then a police officer wrapping a jacket around her. Nina Flam was in the hospital from May to September of that year, recovering from her many injuries. 40% of her body had third-degree burns. Annie's injuries, in position on her bed, showed that the intruder followed the same routine with her as he had done with Nina. The community could not understand how something like this could happen in such a peaceful town like Chatham. Who would do something like this? Nina's account of her assault revealed one telling detail. Her attacker wore a chain around his waist, consistent with the prisoner's belly chain. If someone had escaped from prison, it would be hard to remove without the right tools. From all the bizarre incidents in the weeks leading up to Annie's murder, police were convinced that escaped convict Alan Legere was behind the attack. But they had to keep an open mind and consider the fact that it could have been anyone. Legere was not the only escaped convict at the time. A week before the crime, brothers David and John Tanishuk escaped from prison in Dorchester, just over 100 miles, or about 165 kilometers south from Chatham. Both became suspects in the Flam murder along with Alan Legere. 4 days after Annie and Nina's attack, a Chatham man saw someone outside his house and set out to chase him. But the stalker managed to outrun him and got away. The next day, a landscaper found smoke-gray men's glasses close to where the chase had taken place. Police were able to determine that the glasses were prescription. In fact, they traced the prescription to a pair prescribed to Alan Legere while he was in prison. At the Flam crime scene, forensic technicians found a hair that did not belong to Nina or Annie Flam. Because Nina was sexually assaulted, they were able to get a semen sample. But in 1989, DNA science was still in its infancy. In fact, a lab in Ottawa that would have been capable of completing the testing was still under construction. Despite this, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, or RCMP, were very thorough, obtaining hair and saliva samples from every person they interviewed. At the end of June, the other pair of escaped convicts, the Tanishuk brothers, were apprehended and ruled out. They were found in a hunting camp near the Harcourt area south of Chatham. They were deemed to be too disorganized and incapable of committing the crime. After extensive questioning, both of them were eliminated as suspects in Nina's rape and assault, and also Annie's murder. But they were charged with being unlawfully at large. By July, leads were growing cold. Perhaps the murderer had moved on to another place. Whatever the reason, there were no more attacks. Reports of prowler sightings and strange incidents also became less and less. Once the lab was ready to start DNA testing, scientists were able to obtain a good DNA profile, matching hair and semen samples to blood from a knife Legere was attacked with in prison. The DNA tests were conclusive. Alan Legere was indeed the perpetrator police were looking for. Later that year, in September, 4 months after Annie Flam's murder, reports came in from Newcastle. 70-year-old Morrissey Duran was shot in his back in his Newcastle home when he surprised an intruder. The next day, an armed assailant broke into another Newcastle home and assaulted elderly couple Edwin and Evangeline Russell. Residents of the area were on high alert. People immediately suspected Alan Legere. Was it him out lurking again, planning his next attack? It was Friday the 13th of October 1989. A full moon was illuminating the town of Newcastle. 41-year-old Linda Donnie went to the local Tim Hortons to meet a friend for coffee. Linda lived with her sister Donna in a quiet corner of Newcastle. They mostly kept to themselves, but were well-known and much-liked in their neighborhood. That Friday night, 45-year-old Donna stayed home because she wanted to paint her windows. A neighbor saw her at the window, still painting at 10:15 p.m., waved to Donna, and then went to bed. Around 11 p.m., Linda returned from her coffee date at Tim Hortons. Little did she know that evil was waiting at her home. As she walked up her drive towards the front door, she was struck on her head and dragged inside. What happened in the early morning hours of October 14th at the Donnie sister's home would be similar to the torture that Annie and Nina Flam had endured. Neighbors saw that their house was on fire and alerted the fire department, but it was too late. Linda and Donna Donnie had been murdered. They found both sisters in an upstairs bedroom. The scene bore nauseatingly similar signs to the Flam sisters' home. Both had been sexually assaulted, beaten, and burnt. The victims had been beaten before the fire was even started. It was a very bloody crime scene which told the story of a vicious attack. Down one wall, there were 10 finger trails in blood which showed how one of the victims tried to escape the attack, but couldn't. Local funeral director Brant Adams had known the Donnie sisters for years, but could not tell them apart because they were so badly beaten. Eventually, he identified them by their size, as Donna Donnie was slightly larger than her younger sister. It was not the fire that had killed the sisters. The cause of death was blunt force trauma and strangulation. Linda had a broken jaw and died due to asphyxiation after choking on her own vomit caused by pain. When police learned that the younger of the two sisters, Linda Donnie, had once had a relationship with Alan Legere, they were convinced that he was the man behind the attack. Police thought if it was indeed Legere, that somebody was helping him and hiding him from the police. How else could he have survived in the 6 months since his escape? The community was gripped in fear. People who lived alone, especially elderly citizens, would stay with neighbors or family. Residents bought firearms and guard dogs. They requested more streetlights and installed floodlights to illuminate their homes at night. In fact, so many lights were installed, they were called the Legere lights. Once buzzing with locals and holidaymakers, the streets in the Miramichi were quiet. People were simply too scared to go out. They barricaded themselves into their homes. The quiet streets were dotted with police checkpoints. Black-suited members of the RCMP emergency response team patrolled the area with guns, large vans, and helicopters. The area was under attack, and their boogeyman was Alan Legere. Halloween was coming up, a big celebration in the area. People go all out in decorating their homes. Some people offer tours of haunted houses, and events are held around the area, offering prizes for best dressed and scariest costumes. But during that October, in 1989, the Miramichi found itself in the middle of a real nightmare. People were afraid that during Halloween celebrations, Legere would be able to be amongst the people and their kids wearing a mask as they all went trick-or-treating. The thought was too much to bear. So a decision was made and Halloween was canceled. There would be no official celebration. Some children's parties were held in the daytime, but it was not the same. At a town meeting, members of the community said that they would take the law into their own hands, frustrated at the police's inability to catch the man who caused terror in their lives. One man stood up and said that if Legere came to his home, he would shoot him before he called law enforcement. This statement was greeted with a loud applause as residents agreed. On October 28th, two guns were stolen from a truck parked outside of a motel in Chatham. Police were concerned that Alan Legere had armed himself and that the violence was about to escalate. Police followed up on a report of a sighting and followed Legere into the woods. An officer came close to catching Legere, running after him. It was clear Legere knew where he was going. The wooded areas around the Miramichi was where Legere grew up. He was on home turf. He shot at the officers. The shots seemed to come from all directions. They could not see Legere any longer, but it was clear that he could see them and that he tracked their every move. Fortunately, nobody was injured. By mid-November, police were still actively working on the case of Morrissey Duran and the attack on the Russell couple in Newcastle that had taken place in September. A man called Allard Joseph Villeneuve from Newcastle was arrested and charged with the attacks. There was a moment of relief, and people wondered if there was a slight possibility that Villeneuve could also have been responsible for the Flam and Donnie murders. It was a stressful time for people of the Miramichi. The congregation of the Nativity of the Blessed Virgin Mary Church in Chatham Head flocked to the church to find solace and wanted to be in a safe space. The church held a day of reflection. Father James Smith offered guidance and counseling to the community in a time of fear and anger. His calming words helped the community to keep their faith that the day would come that this terror would be over. Father Smith was a prominent figure in a predominantly Catholic community. He had been a priest for 44 years. Most people were baptized by him, married by him. He buried their loved ones. He was a part of their lives, and he was well respected and well liked. On November 15, 1989, it was a day like any other. Late in the afternoon, around 5:30 p.m., a local high school student dropped the letter off for Father Smith. The priest was eating an early dinner, and everything seemed normal. At 9 p.m., a member of the congregation saw Father Smith on the porch of his house, looking around as though he had heard something. And that was the last time anyone would see the priest alive. Parishioners rolled into church for evening mass on Sunday night, the 16th of November. But there was no sign of Father Smith. And this was very unusual, as he was a punctual man who would never be late for a mass. The congregation of around 30 members waited till 7:15 before two men volunteered to walk over to the rectory next door. What they found was a horrific scene of blood and torture. Father Smith was found dead, lying next to a safe in the hall. When police arrived at the scene, they could see that Father Smith had suffered a prolonged attack. He was tortured to death. His throat had been slashed. He had cut marks on his chest and his jaw was broken. There were broken ribs on both sides of his body. It was broken so badly, the coroner concluded that somebody must have jumped onto his chest and shattered his chest bone and broken his ribs. The attacks were getting more violent every time. It was as if Legere's years of intense hatred towards the Catholic Church was taken out on Father Smith. In the day after the attack, the killer ate, washed his boots, put plastic bread bags on his feet to keep them dry, changed clothes, putting the bloody ones in yet another bag, and didn't notice one bloody footprint on a church magazine. He answered the phone saying, "Wrong number," and later that day, hot-wired the priest's car, a 1984 Oldsmobile Delta 88, and drove off. Perhaps he had to leave in a hurry, but he didn't go down his usual path of setting a fire before he left. This meant that there was a lot of evidence left at the scene. However, forensic technicians could not find anything that would give DNA evidence. Father Smith's car was found within hours at a nearby motel in Bathurst, about 55 miles, or 90 kilometers away. It was parked near a train station. Police also found the priest's jacket and a pair of boots that matched the imprints left at the crime scene. At this point, authorities were certain the man they were looking for was Alan Legere. Police followed the trail to the train station. A rail agent said that he had sold a ticket for a day-nighter to Montreal on the 8:28 p.m. train to a man fitting Legere's description. He remembered because the man stood to one side, trying to hide his face while buying the ticket. At 4:45 a.m., police stopped the train and searched it, looking for a dark-haired man with a tattoo of an eagle head and a star on his right forearm. Passenger number 30 resembled Legere. The man's name was Fernand Savoie of Batouche, but he was much lighter than the 200-pound Legere. He was asked to roll up his right sleeve to his elbow, and there was no tattoo. So they concluded that the man was not their fugitive. Unfortunately, the description given to police was wrong. Alan Legere's tattoo was in fact on his left forearm, not his right. Legere, posing as Fernand Savoie, made it to Montreal and checked into the Queen Elizabeth Hotel, close to Montreal train station. He rarely left his room, but he checked out each day and checked in again. During his stay in Montreal, he visited a pawn shop and sold jewelry that belonged to the Donny sisters for $450. He had money in his pocket, and he was free. But instead of reveling in his freedom, he had an inexplicable need to return to the Miramichi. Back in Chatham, panic escalated after Father Smith's murder. Nobody would dare go outside at night. The man who calmed them and told them that, by the grace of God, the time of terror would pass, was dead, killed by the man that they all feared. It felt like God had forsaken the Miramichi, and that the residents were left to face the devil alone. All resources were made available to police in what became the largest manhunt in Canadian history. Residents felt like they were under siege, that Legere could strike at any moment. He had already stolen their Halloween. Was he going to take away Christmas too? On November 23rd, Ron Gomke was driving his taxi and picked up a passenger in St. John. Then the passenger pulled out a weapon and instructed him to take him 110 miles, that's 177 kilometers, to Moncton. Ron called the dispatcher, who said the fare was $100. When Ron looked at his passenger, he stared down the barrel of a sawed-off .308 rifle. "Tell them you have the fare. I'm the one they're looking for. I'm Alan Legere." Ron did as he was told. He started to drive towards Moncton. He thought about crashing the car intentionally, but before he could do so, a struggle between him and Legere broke out, and on the icy road, the car ended up in a ditch. Legere kept Ron as his hostage and flagged down another car. The driver of the car that pulled over was off-duty police officer Michelle Mercer. Legere ordered Michelle to continue the journey to Moncton. He smoked a joint and would not stop talking, fluctuating between being nice and being threatening. When they came into Sussex, a small town halfway between Moncton and St. John, Michelle said that they were out of gas. They stopped at the Four Corners Irving gas station and convenience. Legere took the keys and money from Michelle Mercer, hid his gun in a plastic bag, and got out to pump gas. But Michelle had a spare key for her car in her purse. Thinking on her feet as soon as Legere was done pumping the gas and went inside to pay, she started the car and drove off to the nearest phone to call police. Legere was not about to give up. He was adamant to make his way back to the Miramichi. He saw a truck at the gas station and got into the cab with driver Brian Golding, who was making his way to Montreal from Halifax. "Come on," he said. "I'm Alan Legere, and we're leaving." It didn't take long for law enforcement to catch up with the truck. Inside, Legere demanded Brian continue driving. But after a 30-minute chase, police managed to force the truck to a halt. Brian opened his door and jumped out shouting, "It's him! It's him! He has a gun!" Legere got out of the truck and surrendered without a fight. He was almost unrecognizable. He was hiding out in the woods for months since his escape and had lost about 40 pounds. He set up camp, living up in the trees. When he was caught, Legere blurted, "I could have done this. I could have done that. I am Alan Legere." But he wasn't almighty after all. He was a coward to the end. He never targeted people stronger than him. He only preyed on people who were defenseless against him. The gentle nature of the victims contrasted sharply with the viciousness of Leger's attacks. When faced with arrest, overpowered by police, he simply gave up. Knowing that Leger loved the notoriety, the media made sure he was portrayed as a weakling. To which Leger responded, "If I am so chicken and dumb, why couldn't over 100 of Canada's finest, with dogs and SWAT teams, find little old moi?" After Leger's arrest, huge relief swept across the region. Church bells were ringing, and people felt safe to go outside again. But things would never be the same. They had seen the dark side, and would always remain cautious. As Leger awaited trial, he was kept in York County Jail. Paul Wayne Stewart, a prison guard, described Leger's time there and how imperative it was to prevent Leger from escaping again. "We had him down in segregation, in the basement, with two cameras in his cell. Two officers sat outside that particular area and monitored the cameras and him 24 hours a day the whole time he was there. The cell door was never opened unless there was two sheriffs, two correctional officers, and 2 to 3 RCMP present. And he was always handcuffed and shackled because the word was, if he escaped, then don't come to work on Monday because you won't have a job." In August 1990, Leger was convicted on charges related to his escape. He stood trial on 4 counts of murder 1 year later, in August 1991. The trial was held outside of the Miramichi, as the jury of locals would not have taken any mercy on Leger, and the fear was that the outcome of the trial would be biased. Prosecution had critical DNA evidence against Leger, but DNA evidence had never been used in court in Canada before this trial. It was new science, and in order to convict Leger, they could not rely on DNA alone. They started with more concrete, trusted forensic evidence. A foot cast of Leger's feet were made, and it proved that Leger wore the boots that had left imprints in the church rectory and had Father Smith's blood on. Nina Flam testified and told the story of her attack. She was honest and brave, and although she wasn't sure who her attacker was, it was clear that he was a local man who knew her family. The trauma of her attack horrified everyone in the courtroom. Leger showed little emotion. Then the time came to present DNA evidence. Experts were brought in to explain the science of DNA fingerprinting. DNA found in semen and hair samples at the crime scenes of Annie Flam and the Donnie sisters matched DNA taken from Alan Leger. Testing concluded that only 1 in 310 million of the Caucasian population would match the profile found at the crime scenes. Leger's defense argued that the shallow gene pool of the Miramichi could have given false results. But this argument was soon laid to rest. In 1991, the whole of Canada's population was only just over 28 million. The DNA match was 1 in 310 million. The chances of the assailant being anyone but Alan Leger were next to none. On November 3, 1991, the jury returned guilty verdicts on all 4 counts of murder. Alan Leger was given a life sentence with 25 years without the possibility of parole. Justice David Dixon told the jury, "I don't usually comment on verdicts, but let me say this, don't lose too much sleep over your verdict." The jail where Leger was kept during his trial was shut down in 1996 and repurposed into a science museum. The cell once occupied by Leger is now used for an exhibit on DNA fingerprinting. Leger is currently in a special handling unit at the maximum security prison in Saint-Anne-de-Plaine near Montreal. He spends 23 hours out of 24 in his cell and is despised by other inmates who don't condone actions of criminals who have victimized women or children. Those who know him know they have to keep a close eye on him. There is always a fear that he might escape again. Prison officials called retired RCMP officer Mason Johnson when Leger's TV was confiscated and he wanted it back. Johnson asked prison guards if they had searched the TV. They said that they did, but they hadn't found anything inside. Johnson insisted, if Leger wanted the TV back, then there had to be something in that TV. And he was right on the money. Inside, prison officials found a set of handcuff keys. Leger will never stop plotting another escape. Until then, the residents of the Miramichi can sleep at night, hoping and praying that their boogeyman never finds his way out of prison again. If you'd like to read more about this case, have a look at the resources used for this episode in the show notes. You would enjoy Dateline's episode covering the case. Also, visit and like our Facebook page at facebook.com/evidencelockerpodcast to see more about today's case. If you like our podcast, please subscribe in Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts. We would also appreciate if you could review the episodes, as it gives us some street cred in the world of podcasting. This was The Evidence Locker. Thank you for listening.